downloading the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of readings and interviews with writers, editors, and agents. This week on the Missouri Review Sound Booth, Tanya McQueen interviews author Colson Whitehead. Please forgive the elevator music in the background of the podcast. We had to catch Colson during his visit to Columbia, Missouri, and the music is the result of the hotel lobby ambiance. Colson Whitehead is the author of 7 books of fiction and nonfiction. He is the recipient of several prestigious awards, and his post-apocalyptic novel, Zone 1, was a New York Times bestseller. Whitehead has also received a MacArthur Fellowship, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Whiting Writers Award, and a fellowship at the Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers. His most recent book, The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death, a nonfiction account of the 2011 World Series of Poker, was just published by Doubleday on May 6th.
I'd like to start by asking you about The Intuitionist. Can you give our listeners some context about the novel?
I was trying to do a sort of takeoff on detective novels. I had written a novel, I'd gone out to a lot of publishers and had been turned down, so I figured, well, my second try, maybe we'll try something a little more linear.
Okay.
The plot, give something like plot. So it seemed so, the detective novel had a good structure for me to play with their conventions, stock characters like the hitman, the corrupt mayor, and so one day I wanted to do detective novel, a sort of fake detective novel. And then one day I was watching 2020, and there was a segment on the hidden dangers of escalators. And they had an escalator inspector. And I thought, oh, that's strange. You don't think about it, but of course someone has to make sure that escalators are working properly. And from growing up in New York City, seeing at the elevator inspection certificate and all the elevators across the city, got me thinking, what if an elevator inspector had to solve a criminal case? Elevator mystery. I was trying to figure out what kind of skills an elevator inspector would bring to a criminal case, and of course, there were none. So it became just all about elevators, and I hadn't been in an elevator world where elevator inspectors are important. Create a school, create philosophical divisions. And so it really just sort of grew from trying to write a linear novel.
How did you do research for the novel?
I just went to the library, local Brooklyn branch, and they had books on history of vertical transport, elevator inspector, licensing exams. The Brooklyn Business Library in downtown Brooklyn had a lot of cool PR material from the Otis Elevator Company.
In terms of research, did you research as you went along and then add it in?
Each book is different. With this one, I did a lot of outlining and doing research before I started. And then once I started writing, if I need something more, I would go back to the library or go back to my notes that I had.
I'm going to read an excerpt from The Intuitionist. So, because there must be patterns, experience is recursive. And if the pattern has not announced itself yet, it will. Eloquent and emphatic in a mild-mannered sort of way. What thematic patterns, if any, do you see in your own work?
I have certain things I like to write about. Technology, cities, how the idea of race changes over time, different communities. I like to put jokes in. So, depending on what I'm working on, those preoccupations of mine are more or less present. The Colossus of New York is about New York City. It's not about technology, not about race. When the Rush Hour chapter, it's just about being in rush hour in big cities, not necessarily New York. And it's not black rush hour, it's just rush hour. There are certain things I like to write about that intrigue me, that I'm trying to figure out. And depending on the book and the work, they're more or less apparent.
I asked this question about patterns because there does seem to be a preoccupation with change, even in some places, a type of anxiety over change in the future. I noticed it in The Intuitionist, and I noticed it in Sag Harbor with Benji. I noticed it at the end of Zone 1. In Zone 1, your zombie apocalyptic novel, and then here's a quote, that was where they were now. The world wasn't ending. It had ended, and now they were in the new place. This preoccupation, it seems, is often tied to the city. I know you grew up in New York, live there now, but I wondered if you were speaking to something larger.
Well, I mean, I think as people, we're always, you know, growing and shedding cells, becoming new people. So we're always sort of building on top of who we were before. And it's true of cities. You know, you have your hometown, and your favorite store is replaced by another store. You hold on to, you know, what the city used to be, superimposing it upon, you know, the new version of the city. I mean, I guess I'm intrigued by that, how we deal with that change within ourselves and our environment. And I think, and you're right, definitely in Zone 1 and Sag Harbor, both of the protagonists are trying to figure out who they were last summer or before the world fell into catastrophe and who they are now.
You seem to incorporate other genres in your books, the detective novel in The Intuitionist, the horror novel in Zone 1, the coming-of-age novel in Sag Harbor. I'm curious if in writing any of these books you ever felt beholden to the structure of the genre.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm doing my own version of a detective novel, my own version of a horror novel, a coming-of-age story, so I don't really care what's gone before. I mean, I'll take whatever conventions I enjoy or want to play with, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm not a card-carrying member of the Detective Writers Union. They're not going to kick me out if I do something wrong. So, you know, the point is to, you know, take forms that I like and have fun with them.
Your novel Sag Harbor is set in the 80s, 1985 to be exact, a time that, in looking back at history, seemed to suggest progress for African Americans. You have things like The Cosby Show, a show that broke racial stereotypes by showing an upper middle class family on television. And in 1986, you have the Martin Luther King holiday being observed for the first time. I've also noticed that with moments of progress, there also seems to be a sort of backlash that happens, like with the Rodney King riots. Sag Harbor was published right after Obama's election, which helped to cement a similar backlash. We see this with what happened with Trayvon Martin as an example. Because this book is not only set in, but was published during these pivotal moments in African-American history, I'm wondering if you took the same characters in Sag Harbor and set them in a contemporary setting, would it create a different story? In what ways do you think their situations would be different?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the book I wrote, so I can't really,
right.
I haven't thought about it. But, you know, I mean, 80s teenagers, Benji's parent generation had a different idea of blackness and what it means to be black in America or middle class or successful in America. The parent generation is different from Benji generation and the grandparent generation that was struggling at the Sag Harbor in the 30s, the sort of newly emergent black middle class. Had a different idea of what striving and being a good, upstanding black person was. So, I mean, I have no idea like what it would look like set in, you know, 2014. Certainly, I mean, I imagine teenagers these days have different preoccupations than I had, than my parents had, than, you know, my grandparents had. So that's one thing. In terms of backlash, I mean, I just think that progress is very gradual. So it's not as if Obama was elected and overnight racism was dispelled. If you start celebrating Martin Luther King Day, racism isn't dispelled. If we change the laws to make employers more cognizant of how many minorities and women they're hiring, doesn't get rid of racism and sexism. It's just a step we're taking towards our better future.
You have this quote about double consciousness early on in Sag Harbor, and it sets the tenor for the rest of the book. As I read through each chapter, I found examples that brought me back to the quote again and again. on some level, the main character Benji and his family have assimilated into this white world, so to speak, and yet there are reminders that in reality they haven't, that through other people's eyes they don't belong. Throughout the book, Benji is concerned with how others view him. He wants to reinvent himself with his name being called Ben, but his friends still see him as Benji, as an example. Even by the end of the book, Benji still is attempting to reinvent himself. So my question is, for African Americans, do you think, can this two-ness, this measuring oneself through the eye of another, ever be reconciled?
Well, I mean, I can't, you know, I'm just a guy, I can't speak for all Black America. I think that the original Du Bois concept of double consciousness, being apart and without, gazing at the mainstream, being gazed upon, is still operative for many cultural groups. In terms of Sag Harbor, it seemed that double consciousness was a very good metaphor for just being a teenager. You know, where do you fit in with your tribe? Where are you separate? What codes do you want to take from the mainstream? And where do you want to keep your own private idea of what the self is? So, you know, for me, ultimately, Sag Harbor is just about being a person on Earth trying to find who you are. He happens to be Black. It informs his perspective and his experiences, and so that changes the way the story is told. But for me, it's really about, you know, finding oneself and ultimately not necessarily tied to his racial background. It's more tied to being human.
Looking back at your career, is there anything you would have done differently?
Well, I mean, sure. I mean, I'm not going to share it, but
okay.
Yeah, there are things I would do differently. I mean, hopefully I'm a better writer now and a better, conceptualist of my work. So, and I'm a different person. So if I wrote the Intuitions now, it'd be different just because I see the world differently. And in terms of just on a technical level, I've learned to do things differently. Keeping it to myself, but I would, there are a few things, but, in the end, the books are the books, and The Intuitionist is the book I wrote when I was 28, and I did the best I could do. Apex High to Hurt is, I wrote in my early 30s, and I just tried my hardest, and that's how it came out. So, it doesn't really, it's not really profitable to sort of look back and figure out what would change. Better to concentrate on the next book. Try to make that the best book you can do for whatever talent you can marshal at 45 or 46.
I was looking at it from an advice standpoint.
Well, I mean, no book is perfect. It's just the best you can do, at that time in your life.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have friends who used to want to write, and they would write 100 pages of a novel, and then start revising it, and never get the page 101 because they kept going back to the beginning. I mean, I think you have to keep going. It may turn out terrible, and then you start over again with a new book. Definitely, I think learning how to let go of a book that hasn't gone anywhere because no one else likes it or you can't figure out how to do it is very important. And, keep trying that new thing.
When you were working on The Intuitionist, were you still working at The Village Voice?
I was cutting back so I could, concentrate on writing. I need full, when I'm writing fiction, I need like a whole full day free. So I would like write an article and that would buy me 2 or 3 days of fiction writing, and then write another short article and that would buy me another couple days. So I was cutting back just because, I was spending more time concentrating on my fiction, but of course I had to eat, so.
How do you organize your writing time now?
There are times, small kids or I'm working and I don't have like a full day or if I have an hour, I'll take an hour. But ideally, say I'm teaching 2 days a week and I have 5 days, or I'm teaching a couple days a week and that buys me a semester off. I don't write every day. Some days I just don't feel it. I just don't do anything. I guess when I'm really working on a novel, I try to get like maybe 7 or 8 pages a week. It seems like a good pace. And it can be 2 on Monday and 3 on Wednesday and then catch up on the weekend. make it eight. Or it can be nothing Monday through Friday and then eight pages Saturday and Sunday. But because, you know, it is such a marathon, if I can keep a pace of eight pages a week, that seems to make kind of sense. So it works for me. It doesn't work for everybody, but it works for me. And then I'm doing that when I'm working on the book. And when I'm, you know, once I'm done, I'll take a year off or a year and a half and not write, just sort of hang around the house.
You wrote an op-ed for the New York Times called How to Write a couple years ago, which is a kind of play on all the cliched advice given to writers in workshops and in instructional how-to books. You teach writing now, correct?
I mean, I visit various places, and now I'm teaching at Princeton and NYU.
How do you approach teaching writing in a workshop?
I try to be open to whatever they want to write. You know, I try to tell them to get out of their usual writing voice and try different things, different genres. You know, for if you're writing 3 or 4 stories a semester, and you always write about, I mostly teach undergrads, so if you only write about 18-year-olds who are very much like you, try a male voice, a female voice. You're always writing first person. So, and again, you know, I sort of try to emphasize stretching yourself. You know, just I think a workshop is a place to fail and try different things, and definitely when you get your MFA, that community where you're sort of apart from the world and writing with people who have to read your writing, you're hopefully, you know, being taught by people who know what they're doing and can point you. So books, ways of thinking about, you know, writing that you hadn't thought of. It's a good time to pretend you're in a lab and try different things. So I'm open to whatever they want to bring in, and I sort of urge my students to try stuff they've been reticent about writing.
Do you encourage rule breakers?
I don't see rule breakers. I mean, I think there aren't any rules. So
okay.
I mean, they're people who. Were instructive when I was younger, let's say, Pynchon or Nathaniel West. There are people who are playing with fractured structure now, like, say, Juno Diaz and Drown, or Jennifer Egan and Goon Squad. But that, I mean, it all seems very natural. I think people have been doing that for the last 120 years. So this is not really breaking rules, they're just doing their own sort of spin on things. And also, I don't think it's important to break rules. I think you should just write, I think there are, straight realists who I like. They're people who play more with structure. I've written, straight realistic books. I've written stuff that's more fantastic. So, I definitely use whatever's in the toolkit for whatever project I'm working on. The appropriate tools for what I'm working on, and I admire people who are just, doing their own thing and, appearing to enjoy it.
You're active and really funny on Twitter. For people who follow you, who would you suggest other people to follow?
So I have weird comedians like Rob Delaney, who's sort of Twitter comic phenomenon. Patricia Lockwood, a poet who writes these weird, bizarre, naughty tweets that are totally off the wall. For a while, I did follow a lot of good people, and I've cut back to them just like talking about the same, likable characters, or there's always some sort of weird and inane discussion going on. Everyone's chattering back and forth about it. So I mostly just follow news people, I'm a news junkie, and breaking news I get from Twitter. And I follow weird comics, a lot of unknown comics. Just people who I don't even know what they do that are sort of these weird Twitter people I follow. You say things that sort of find amusing from time to time.
About a month ago on the Missouri Reviews blog, we had a post by comedian Wes Hazard about what music to play while picking up Colson Whitehead from the airport. Making that connection between writing and music, when writing, what music do you listen to?
Sure, no, no. I music keeps me company. I'm a big music fan. So I just play like my playlist of like 1,200 songs. And it's Prince and Sonic Youth and Daft Punk and The Stooges, The Clash, Blondie. So it's really just songs I like. They make me happy.
If you had to pick a representative song for each of your books, what would they be?
I can't really, because I mean, I really listen to such different stuff. But with Zone One, I finished it. I was like, Zone One were a book, were three songs. What did I say? It would be Reuters by Wire. Is it Dead Souls by Joy Division? The song that's sort of based on a Wilfred Owen. And Welcome to Terror Dome is in there.
Were there any that you listened to a lot when you were writing a particular book?
Well, because of Sag Harbor, I got back into songs I liked when I was younger, so a lot of 80s music. So
okay.
Echo the Bunny Men and Susan the Banshees. There's a period when I was writing John Henry, and I was listening to Radiohead and Spiritualized, Metallica's live concert, live record with the orchestra, and the Beastie Boys compilation. I have a ritual whenever I finish a book is to put on Purple Rain and Daydream Nation. I have about 2 pages left.
Can you talk a little about your new book, The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death, that comes out in May?
Sure. No, I mean, I just finished Zone One, and Grantland, which is a online sports pop culture magazine, approached me, wanted to know if I wanted to write for them. And I don't really follow sports, but they heard like poker. So they're like, what if we gave you $10,000 to enter the World Series of Poker, and you wrote about it. So my article fee was the entrance fee. Which would have been great, except I hadn't really played tournament poker before. I had a very sort of mellow $5 volume game, and ended up having 6 weeks to train for World Series of Poker. So I would go to Atlantic City. I would drop off my kid at school and then catch a bus in Atlantic City and like go to different casinos playing tournaments, trying to improve my skills, cramming various poker books. I got a poker coach, a woman named Helen Ellis, who writes YA novels and also plays poker. And she gave me tips on how to play and where to play. And then I went to the World Series and wrote about it in 4 installments. And I had such a great, I don't like leaving the house. So being an actual like participatory journalist was fun. And learning new things about poker, which I love, but didn't really understand in a sort of higher level that these guys play at was great. I wasn't done. I wrote 60 pages. That was the piece, and I had a lot more to say. So it seemed a nice change of pace when I write a nonfiction book about that experience. Make it hopefully very funny. I want to just have a lot of my weird jokes in there. A lot of weird jokes about despair and depression. I don't know. I think it turned out really well. I'm really proud of it. I like reading from it. Brings back that sort of those 6 weeks when I was training.
How does beef jerky fit in?
You have to read the book. I mean, Jax Link's beef jerky, for the big sort of national beef jerky brand, is the main sponsor of the World Series of Poker.
Okay.
And the official title of World Series of Poker is Jack Link's presents World Series of Poker. It's in there.
Do you still play poker now?
Not so much. I mean, my regular game was sort of dying down anyway because everyone has kids or we're working and stuff like that. And then learning how to really play sort of ruined me for really casual games. I get really upset now when people play poorly. Whereas before, I didn't care. It was a very social game. But now I sort of get irritated. And then I'm not going to become a professional poker player, so I'm not going to start playing casino. So I'm sort of in this in-between place where I don't really have a regular game. I still love it, but I have to figure out what my sort of stakes are.
You've been listening to the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. Music by Mark Catalano. Check us out online at MissouriReview.com. There you can subscribe to the magazine, follow our Poem of the Week feature, and enter our 2014 Jeffrey E. Smith Editor's Prize with $5,000 cash prizes in poetry, fiction, and essay. Thanks for listening, and check back next week for a new episode of the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast.